Thanks for listening to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. You're now on episode 11 here for January 23rd, 2018. And I am delighted to have Stefan Bollinger here in the co-pilot seat to join me for today's geeky adventure on the latest and greatest photography news with a geek twist. And I don't know if he's up for it. I think from previous conversations, he's got that geek ramble down pat. So let's put that to the test here. Welcome, Stefan.
Hello. I'm a born geek. I just try to hide it and pretend that I'm an artist. But the truth is, yeah, there's a little bit of geek in all of us, isn't it?
There is. And, you know, sometimes it's fun to just listen to a conversation like anybody that's listening to this podcast, even if you're unsure about all of the details and some of it goes over your head, a lot of it does get absorbed. And so there were a few curious things that came about in the geek news this week. But before we get to that, I want to know what's going on in your world. What's keeping you busy these days?
What keeps me busy these days? Well, first of all, I'm trying to get over a cold. But if people think that the strange accent comes from that, no, I'm still struggling with the English language. One day I will master it, but until then I will always have a Swiss accent. So in case you wonder, yes, that's where it comes from. What keeps me busy? I'm producing photos. I hope people like them. If not, I don't really care that much because I just have too much fun doing it. And I'm producing music. I'm producing videos. I'm talking to people. And that's pretty much what I like most is entertain people in any way I can, be it musically, be it photographically, or be it just over a good beer and having a big smile on my face. I think that's my life.
It's all good fun. If only we could all just have conversations over beer and be paid for it. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
I'd be a millionaire.
You mentioned, you know, you love taking pictures, and I know what kind of stuff that you take photographs of, but why don't you share some of your photographic muses with those listening?
Well, I think I have two muses, if you want to call it that way. On one side, because I'm married to a former professional ballet dancer, I've started taking dance photos for a long time now, 25 years. Very, very terrible photos at the beginning. By now, I think I slowly get the hang of it, and give me another 20 years and I'll be really good at it. But yeah, that's one of the big parts of what I do. And the other thing is, simply because I love dealing with people, is portraiture. That's probably what most people, those few who know me, they would know me as a portrait photographer. I am terrible when it comes to snowflakes or any kind of weird things. But simply for the reason that snowflakes or food or anything that is static doesn't talk back to me. And what fascinates me most in my work is that I'm dealing with real life people, with real life stories, with real life background, with different sizes and shapes, and they all have their own mind and taste. And that motivates me to create things that not only I like, but they like. And having those conversations during a photo shoot, I think that is part of why, hopefully, my photos speak then also to the viewer, because there is, at least so I wish, a little bit of personality in there.
Right. And when you talk about personality, it's important to know, like if you're photographing a ballet dancer, I mean, they're clearly enjoying their experience, right? They love what they do, or let's hope that they do. And to kind of capture their personality coming through those actions, it's a very dynamic narrative. And it's a very personal one. It would be different from one person to the next. So I can totally understand why that is appealing to you. And it's a very psychological experience as well, because a lot of the work involved with that kind of photography happens without the camera present. It's building a rapport. It's getting inside their head, letting them get inside your head to bounce ideas around and figure out what's going to be able to create that one fantastic image that they could say, yes, this is me at my best. And have everybody else look at that and say, wow, you know, this is her or him or whoever it is, absolutely 100%. That's not an easy thing to get. And so you've got the skill set to do it. And I'm envious of that because that's not the kind of subject that I work with at all.
Oh, well, that's the beauty, isn't it? That we all have our little niche and we all can, you know, people. The funny thing is when you do workshops or talk to people, it's always the same narrative that they go like, oh, there's so many photographers out there and everybody does it and it's getting so hard. And I'm thinking, no, it's such a wide field. If you will find what you like and then you go for it. And if you really are passionate about it, I think the technical stuff is easy. You know, I mean, I'm not saying everybody can do it, but I'm saying everybody can learn it. And it's a question of where is your heart and where is your personality? If you're an introvert and you're scared of people, well, maybe portrait photography is not for you. Maybe you have to go and photograph trees in the sunset. But if you talk to this tree and you wonder, why is that tree never talking back to me? Maybe you have to find some people somewhere.
Well, you know, and I like to add myself into an image as sort of a person of interest, an anchor point, and a building of narrative sometimes because the landscape itself is missing that component. But I'm often, you know, tromping through the woods and there's nobody else that's going to go with me being eaten by mosquitoes. And so sometimes that is a solo experience for me. And I, you know, I was always an introvert when I was growing up. And maybe that reflects in a lot of my work as well, though I love teaching and talking in front of groups now. I'll sit in my studio for 3 or 4 hours and just tinker and just explore an idea, a concept. And I enjoy the process of trying to do something, regardless of if it's a success or a failure and making mistakes and taking that mistake and saying, okay, well, that's just now a problem I have to solve. And the problem solving elements within that are really engaging for me. So 4 hours might go by and I might not have anything but new ideas, but I still walk away from that quite happy. Like just the other day, I had a car, unfortunate car repair needed. The radiator started leaking, and so there was a bunch of you know, giant puddle of antifreeze on my driveway, and my car needed you know, some TLC, and it was a very expensive repair. But we also heat our house in the wintertime here with a wood stove, and I've got a bunch of wood just sitting on my driveway that I haven't had the time to put away yet. So I was grabbing some of it and moving some of it, and I noticed the most beautiful frost formations underneath one of these pieces of wood on my driveway. And I just put two and two together. It's because of the antifreeze. I guess it's made of polypropylene glycol and water as a mixture. And that keeps the water below the freezing point, but still liquid. So it evaporates into a super cooled state and then freezes on impact with anything that it comes into contact with. So I've been trying all winter to make frost. I've got a heated dog bowl outside in my backyard that would keep the water warm, and I would put stuff on top of it that the water vapor would be able to freeze onto, but it wasn't really beautiful frost. I tried putting an ultrasonic humidifier outside and have it generate all this water vapor to create something, and it didn't work. The secret solution to this whole problem just randomly appeared: antifreeze. I need to stick a bowl full of antifreeze in my backyard and then place strategically a beautiful flower or a branch of a tree or whatever I want the frost to grow on top of that. And then I will get this wonderful subject that I could then photograph. So that tinkering process often yields no results until randomly out of the blue, aha, the light bulb goes off. And now I'm just waiting for it to get cold again, which will be happening tomorrow for me to see if this experiment will actually work. And I hope it does.
Okay, you lost me at freeze, but I could listen to you for hours coming up with, oh, this and this and this chemical, this and that and the other. And I'm thinking, if I would talk like this to anybody in front of me, they would run away so quickly because they think, what the heck? They ask me, see, my world looks so different. They ask me, does my bum look big in this? And the only answer to that is, well, you need to use some antifreeze. And I can tell you exactly the right guy. Anyway, I think it's fascinating what you do, but I have to admit, half of what you just said went straight over my head.
but you're still smiling about it. And so that makes me happy.
Now, I'm smiling about the results that you produce because, and I think that is something that people sometimes forget. Do you always have to know how it is made, or can you just look at it and be in awe of it and go, oh my God, this looks amazing. I want it on my wall. Do I then care if it's done with oil or antifreeze or... Ooh.
Who knows what else? But, you know, I did package up and send out 7 snowflake prints to the UK today. And they asked me specifically, because when I make those posts online, I share like a written page's worth of content describing how that particular snowflake was formed, you know, the physics behind it or how it was captured, if there was any particularly interesting camera techniques involved. And they specifically asked me, along with the prints, can you make a version of that text on a separate sheet that they could put behind the frame as a conversation piece, because they were giving these as gifts. And that extra knowledge adds value to the image. Which brings me to a quote from Dr. Brian Cox from the introduction of the BBC series Forces of Nature. I've memorized the quote because I shot the title card sequence for this documentary. But he says, you know, the world is beautiful to look at, but it's even more beautiful to understand. And so that understanding itself adds an extra layer of respect and appreciation for what that subject happens to be. So there is value in that too. But sometimes you can just look at it and just be lost in the beauty and you need nothing more than that.
If I would apply this, I love that quote, by the way, but if I would apply this to taking photos of young women who are just beautiful, I will never fully understand them.
Very true. You got me there. All right. Well, we've gone for a nice little preamble here to warm ourselves up, and let's get into a fun geeky product that is soon to be available. This is the world's first variable GND or graduated neutral density filter. So variable meaning like a variable neutral density filter in which you would have two polarizing films that would work in opposition to each other to eventually become completely black or very, very close to it. And when they are in alignment, well, then it would just function like a polarizer. So this is a product from Aurora Aperture, and it's on Kickstarter right now, and they're completely funded. They've blown past their funding goals, where one half of the filter, no matter how you turn it, will always be relatively clear. And the other half of the filter will have the graduated or the neutral density filter. And I kind of stumble on the word graduated, Stefan, because it's not. That's the one real big sticking point for me on this one. It's really a solid line right down the middle of this. And so when I started looking at this at first, I thought, well, this could be an interesting, unique idea. But that real solid, hard line does not sell it for me. What do you think of this? And have you ever used a neutral density filter or a graduated neutral density filter of some form?
Of course. I mean, there's certain filters that I believe belong in every pack. When the moment you leave the studio and you go out, you know, a polarizer and neutral density filters, you have to deal with the sun, and depending on what the weather is doing, you have to adjust for it. And if you want certain shutter speeds or whatever the situation requires, yes, of course. I cannot see myself, however, using something that is so limiting. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, being able to change the amount of darkening is amazing. But we've seen that before. That's not something new, right? But why would I have, unless I shoot architecture, maybe, or I have the perfectly flat horizon, or if I'm on a helicopter flying over the ocean and I have, hopefully don't shoot too wide because I would already get a curvature in there, but I need something dead straight to use this filter. I mean, I'm a people shooter, so for me it makes probably even less sense, but I can't see where I would use this. I would always like to have some kind of a disguise that when you look at the final result, you don't really see how it's made. And I think with something like this, where there's such a hard cut between the transparent and the darkened area, I'm not sure where to. I'm a bit speechless because I would like to have some sort of a gradient. And in the description, once you sent me this link, it mentions a hard gradient. And I'm thinking, this is like a straight curve, a hard gradient. What is it?
Yeah, and I'm looking at their funding right now. They are more than 300% funded. So apparently some people are jumping on board for this. But it's a really hard thing for me to get behind, especially because I love to deal with this sort of thing in post. Not that I'm trying to make it more difficult for myself, but I shoot things with uneven horizons. You know, I try to recover highlights from a file by shooting an underexposed version of the image and then painting in some of those details that might have been overexposed in the regular image for a general exposure. And this is not a difficult thing to do. You just bracket your shots, and I don't process them as an HDR. That's not probably the best way to go about it, but you have all of the possible information. You could take a darker frame and a lighter frame and use a graduated a layer mask in Photoshop, and it'll give you a very similar result, except now you can control exactly how that that gradient will apply. There are a few exceptions where that won't work, taking two separate shots, but it's far more flexible than a tool like this. Now, the key is I know how they make this, or at least I've got a suspicion as to how they make this. And I could potentially make my own for, maybe about $10, maybe less. So here's the idea. You can get polarizing films that, I've got this little square bit here sitting on my desk because why not? But every LCD screen ever made has a polarizing film in front of it. The the light from those screens is polarized by its very nature. And you can search on eBay for replacement polarizing sheet for, you know, a 27-inch monitor or a 32-inch TV, and you'll find a ton of stuff cheap from China. And you can just buy, you know, a selection of these sheets. And some of them are sticky. A lot of them have a stickiness to them. So if you take some other cheap eBay purchases, like a cheap variable ND filter that will have those two components together, and a cheap UV filter, all you have to do is take apart the variable ND filter and take that cheap UV filter, apply some of this film to it, stick it on there, put it in the variable ND filter, and now you have a variable graduated, air quotes, ND filter. For, you know, the cheap stuff coming out of China, it's going to be pretty bad quality, but I don't know if it's going to be any less useful than this particular product. But because what I assume they're doing, and this is just my assumption based on my current tinkerings, they're just cutting some of this sheet material and sticking that onto a piece of glass, which would be that hard cut. It would be an engineering difficulty, for lack of a better word, to have that fade off softly. You would have to specifically engineer the polarizing film to be applied in some unusually fading way that I have never seen done before. So they're not reinventing anything here. There's no new technology. It's just a new way to fit some puzzle pieces together that nobody thought they needed. And I think that about sums it up.
Well, the beautiful thing about photography gear is that you will always find someone who desperately needs it. And then you will have some people who think, what would I do with this? And that's fair enough. At the end of the day, you can buy a cheap little car with four wheels, a radio and a heater, and you're fine. But then other people, they desperately want a BMW and are happy to pay $150,000 more than the other car, which gets them from A to B just as well. And I think with a lot of those more geeky things or more specialized things, some people will be happy to pay a premium price just to have it. And then I'm pretty sure there will be some architectural photographers who have been waiting for something like this. For me, it makes very little sense. But isn't that also the beauty about our industry, that there are so many different facets? And I'm pretty sure someone will write some kind of a review going ballistic over how terribly limiting it is, and then 2 weeks later you find a review on YouTube where they go like how amazing it is. So good for them that they are 300% funded. I congratulate them. I think it's awesome. Invent some more stuff now that you have the funds, and maybe something is in it for me next time.
Yeah, you know, if this was an actual gradient, this product would be more valuable to a lot of people. And so hopefully a version 2 coming down the road will be able to add that ingenuity, however they have to engineer that to happen. Looks like they might have the funding to at least dip their toe in the water and start the experimentation once they get this production out the door. So I wish them all the best of luck, just like you did. But it does limit its usefulness. And if people are, you know, inventive enough to come up with something like this on their own, that experience of putting one together for a few dollars, I think would be a valuable just photo geekery experiment. Whenever I do that stuff, I get 5 or 6 new ideas to start exploring as well. So kudos to them. And anybody that wants to build their own, just send me an email if you didn't figure it out from my brief description on the podcast here. But let's move on to the next story, which is kind of in two parts. Now, we're talking about sort of niche things on this episode. And so the next story is Kodak showing off their Super 8 hybrid digital camera with a sample reel, with the best they could muster from all of the prototypes and beta units, I guess, that they've sent out to a variety of different people. Stefan, what do you think of this entire endeavor from Kodak?
Yeah, where do I go from here? Super 8 camera, isn't, I don't know. I think cars are pretty awesome. We don't have to go back to horses and carriages. And if I want a certain look nowadays, I can shoot with a Red Cinema camera, or I can shoot with, you know, all the digital gear that we have these days, and I can produce that look relatively easy in the digital realm. So is there some kind of something to it, to this going back to film and everything? Sure there is, but I think it's more of a nostalgia than an actual useful product as such, because let's face it, a camera like this, yes, they now put a digital display on and you can, you know, control certain things now on a display. But at the end of the day, you still have to send in your film to be developed. Then whoever develops this, however they do it, you have no way to control how that film is developed. And then that film comes back to you. Now, in today's world, I would like to have full control over how my end result looks, and development of a film for me is a big part of it. So maybe I'm too picky in that regard, but if I want that filmish kind of look, if I want, you know, limitations in terms of black levels and white levels and all that kind of stuff, I can do this all digitally. And yes, if you use high-end cameras, as I mentioned, with a Red Cinema camera or something like that, I have all the information there, and then it's completely up to me how I want visually to style this. Do I have to go back in time to horses and carriages to get from A to B? I don't get it. I think it's more of a gimmick. Maybe Kodak feels like they haven't done anything for a long time and now have to go sort of back to where they came from. It's nice, but I don't see much use in it. That's just me.
Yeah, it's actually a really nice looking device, to be honest. I mean, they hit that all the design points that I would like to see in a product like this, even though I would never want a product like this to exist. It does take an SD card, which will record audio so that you could sync that up with the Super 8 video after you get that back in scanned form. But you're right about the controlling of the film development, because if you're shooting film photographically or cinematographically, whatever that word is, you want to have the ultimate control. And I know when I've shot black and white film, there's a lot of different developers that you can choose. You know, there's a dozen that I could readily get from local suppliers. And it's almost kind of confusing when you just kind of look at the shelf and you think, okay, well, which one does what? And you might experiment with a few of them, figure out what works best for you. For what you want to create, different effects overall, and you lose all of the control with this. Not only that, Super 8 is such low resolution. It's awful. I mean, it's not just you're looking for a filmy, grainy look that you can blow up onto a big screen. If you blow that up onto a big screen, it's going to look like a home movie from the 1950s. And maybe that's the look you're after. But you can go the easy way and apply, like you mentioned, in digital processing, an effect that would be pretty much indistinguishable these days from what we're getting. The real kicker for me is the price tag. There's no solid price given yet, but it's currently suggested that it will be between $2,500 and $3,000 US for this camera. And that's not including the cost of consumables, the cost of the film and the developing that's required from that. So this has been a long going project for Kodak, though. I remember hearing about this at least 2 years ago. And so over that time, it's now closer and closer to market, and they haven't done away with it. So it's likely that we will see this very soon. Maybe I should, I don't want to say I'll buy one, but, you know, a few years after they're on the market, the price of a used one will probably be 1/10 of what their current asking price is. I figure, who knows? Maybe it's just, I don't get it. It's from a different experience, a different class, of image makers and art creators, but it's just I'm left scratching my head on this one, and I can't figure out why such an anachronism exists.
Well,
so
my guess is that there is, you know, nostalgia, as I mentioned, is something beautiful. I mean, there is a certain warmth to old film. There's a certain underlying gut feeling to it. And I understand that some people like to go back and like to maybe make things easier, right? Now, there's control freaks like you and me that like to have 100% control over everything we do. And we want to have, the abilities to completely control the outcome. But then there's also a certain charm in just point and shoot and get whatever there is. And maybe it is grainy and maybe it is, sorry to say like that, resolution. But there is a certain charm to it. And I understand that. However, what I don't get is that I can use an iPhone and I can film this and I push it through a cheap free software and I can apply a filter. And now I get a very, very similar look. Now, if I want exactly that look, I might have to buy a certain plugin that actually analyzed what a proper processed film looks like in terms of grain, in terms of different values of the different colors, the called tone mapping, the LUTs, and so on and so forth. That's all cool. So I can actually even do it mathematically properly and really create digital footage that looks like analog footage. And it's you could actually measure it and it is exactly the same. Here is my point, though. Down the track, in 5 years, in 10 years, if you have the digital file, you can change your mind. However, when you film it with that thing, it is how it is forever. So why not be a little bit smart and say, right now, I love this grainy look. I love the low resolution. I love the loss of blacks. I love this and that and the other. Cool. But preserve the originals. Shoot it as pristine as you can. Convert it to what you like right now. But maybe in 10, 15, 20 years, when your kids grown up, they maybe actually want to see how they really looked like. So be a little bit smart about it. That's why people always ask, why should I shoot in 4K today? My TV doesn't support it. Well, not now, but what about in 10 years? Be smart about it. Do what you like now, but save your bum.
Exactly. And I couldn't have said that better myself. Especially this, you mentioned, okay, well, maybe somebody engineers a software plugin that handles everything perfectly. Like they really go into the weeds and make sure that it's as accurate as possible to the Super 8 feel. I don't think they would charge you $2,000 for that plugin. I think it's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper than that. So again, it kind of brings it full circle that I'm not sure if it would be a smart choice. I just can't get behind something like that. But on the other end of the spectrum, This week, Hasselblad has announced their it was the H6D 400C multi-shot camera that captures 400 megapixel images. And so, you know, it'll take between, and six shots in the multi-shot mode, more getting higher resolution. And so you can shoot at one shot, four shot, or six shot. And the result is just absolutely astounding for what this camera is able to return to you as a finished product. Now, it's not going to be for you, Stefan, if you're shooting a ballet dancer that's actively moving. You know, multi-shot cameras are not the solution for that. But it would be for artwork reproduction, architecture photographers, people that work in museums or educational institutions that are cataloging archives of artifacts or insect specimens, whatever it happens to be. So when you look at the possibilities for, you know, what this camera brings to the table compared to what was previously available, I think their previous version of this was 200 megapixels. And so now they've doubled that up to 400. And their price tag is, it's up there. I mean, it's the cost of, $48,000, I think. So, you know, I spent about that on a luxury automobile recently that we will be paying off for a few years to come. But if you're an institution for something like this, this makes a heck of a lot more sense in terms of an investment than the Kodak Super 8 camera. It's expensive. It's a niche product, but it's actually fulfilling a need that some people actually have. Would you like to get your hands on one of these?
Yes, Hasselblad, if you're listening, I am absolutely open to any kind of endorsements. I love Hasselblad, but I might have a different kind of a background because I come from a medium format background back in the film days. I always loved the format. I loved the size of the sensor. I love things that have nothing to do with the 400 million pixels. It has to do with the fact that depth of field is very, very different if you have a big sensor. A lot of people don't really understand that the size of sensor has such a huge impact that if you put a 50 mil lens on a 35 mil sensor and you get a certain bokeh and then you put it on the medium format sensor and out of nowhere, it's just so much more creamy. So for me, medium format always had a special place in, not in my heart, but you know what I mean. It has a certain look. Now, the other thing is also with a camera like this, as the version before, you know, you're actually shooting at proper 16-bit. The colors that you're actually capturing is insane compared to what most DSLR are capable of. Most DSLRs are somewhere between 12 and 14-bit. Now, that might not sound like a big difference from 14 to 16, but trust me, there is, especially when you are in tricky situations. So now you add the chance to actually shift the sensor and go up to 400 million pixels. If you photograph or you document an original Picasso or an original Leonardo da Vinci painting, and you really want all those details, $40,000 is nothing looking at a multi-million dollar painting that has to be archived. Now, if you return this and say, I'm going to Vegas and I want to take some photos on the streets, well, maybe this is a slightly overkill. So I guess horses for courses, as they say. But people underestimate what a difference it makes to have such a big sensor to shoot at 16-bit. The only thing where I think this camera is a little bit weird is why now people want to shoot 4K video with it. There are better solutions to shoot 4K video than with this Hasselblad monster. I mean,
this is not a video camera.
It offers it, right? It offers 4K video. And the other thing that, you know, people also have to understand, I think where we sometimes go wrong is with this megapixel. You have to really wonder, where does it actually make sense to go to such a resolution? Now, in my world, I don't shoot famous paintings as much as I love to admire them, but I don't document them. I take pictures for advertising as example. Now, if you shoot for a billboard that is 20 meters long, you would assume that you need a lot of resolution. Truth is, it will be printed at 25 pixels per inch. It's never going to be printed at 300 DPI because
nobody's going to nose up to it and say, hey, this looks grainy.
Yeah, nobody will ever be that close. So even if you go to any canvas place that produces a canvas just for yourself, they printing usually at 110, 150 DPI max. They're never going to print a normal canvas that hangs in your living room that you're actually getting close to. You're never going to print at actually 300 DPI. So where do you need that kind of resolution? I'm doing this commercially. I'm making money with advertising photos that are printed large. And I don't need this. But I can absolutely see the use in what you said, documenting art and architecture and this and that and the other.
Making something that's archival, right? Like I did an artwork reproduction project recently, and it was for Project Remembrance. It was a series of, I think, 32 or 36 paintings, some of them being 8 feet wide or so. And in order to get the resolution that I needed, I shot this as a grid panorama. And I moved the camera around, and then I lowered the tripod down, and then I did another row, and so on and so forth. And I got a fairly decent resolution as a result of those efforts. But wouldn't it be nice to just get everything perfectly lined up and take one photograph? You don't have to worry about all of the stitching potential errors. You don't have to worry about any of the lens distortion issues. There's a lot of things that would be an advantage to having a camera like this, especially because you're allowed to rent it. Hasselblad is saying that they're going to be renting this out for $480 a day. Well, if you've got a big job that requires this kind of hardware, and your customer is willing to pay a little bit extra for it, that makes a huge amount of sense rather than owning one that 90% of the time or more is never going to be used. It's just going to be sitting there collecting dust. So the rental model, I think, is a great idea for cameras like this. And I encourage anybody that has a project that is archival in nature to maybe spend a little bit of extra money and take the big guns with you for that one specific task. Now, I want to go back to something that you mentioned before being 16-bit. If you look at JPEGs, they're 8-bit. And 8-bit files give you, for the red, green, and blue color channels, 256 levels of brightness. And the connection of those three will give you every possible color that an 8-bit file can create. And it's not a lot in the bigger picture. When you go up to 14-bit, you're looking at around 16,000 and change for every color channel, for the red, green, and blue, 16,000 separately. And when you go to 16-bit, at 65,000 values for red and 65,000 for green and the same for blue, and add a few hundred extra. So when you take a look at the potential for mapping colors accurately and making sure that every gradation, no matter how slight, is absolutely perfect, then it's going to be perfect. You don't need that level of perfection for most things, but if it is a mission critical tool, then you've got it. And my current camera does not have that. So yeah, you get a lot for within this package, but it does cost a significant more than your average camera. But I guess it's sort of the law of diminishing returns. I mean, you can go out and buy a good camera for $300. You know, you can't walk into a camera store and buy a bad camera, you know, at least compared to what was on the market a few years ago and so on and so forth. But if you want a great camera, add a zero. If you want a greater camera, add a zero, you know, but it's still going to all boil down to you as an artist. A camera like this is designed not so much to be operated by a photographer as an artist, but a photographer as a technician. And I think there's a very important distinction to be made there.
Yeah, absolutely. Nevertheless, it's a monster. And I repeat myself, Hasselblad, by any, feel free. There's a great lineup. And what I actually like about this camera, even though this specific one, I think the 100 megapixel one would be perfect for me. I like the fact that it's still till today, a modular system. you can actually take the digi back off and put a film back still on. It still works. I like the fact that they keep pushing it, that they don't just say, okay, well, you know, most people now take photos with their iPhones, blah, blah, blah. I think it's cool. You know, those guys in Sweden, they still keep pushing the limits. They're still coming up with new things, but they're sticking also to their traditions, to making sure, you know, you can take it apart. The top part comes off, the back comes off, this and that and the other. I also think that a lot of people don't actually understand the difference between a leaf shutter and, you know, that the shutter is actually part of the lens, not the camera itself. There's a lot of things in there that I think most people don't even think about. And I think it's awesome that they keep pushing it, that they keep going. 400 megapixel, is it for everybody? No, it's insane, but it's insanely cool at the same time.
Oh, and you know, we'll get there eventually. The technology will come that we will have. I forget, it was Nokia had a 40 megapixel cell phone camera a few years back, and they did pixel binning. They just kind of averaged things out, and that was the way that they you know, claimed 40 megapixels, but didn't actually really deliver it at the end of the day, because diffraction on a smaller sensor is going to limit you significantly. So, you know, you can shift the sensor around even at medium format. 400 megapixels is a tough thing to get, because if you were to scan a well-exposed and well-developed high-detailed 4x5 negative, which is much larger, you might max out at 400 megapixels. So, you know, sensor size is one of those deciding factors, but we're still going to keep pushing forward and finding a way to beat physics down. And the pixel shift is one of those latest technologies that lets us kind of surpass the previous limits that we once had.
And also don't forget.
All right. Well, let's.
And also don't forget.
Okay. Continue.
Yes.
Final thought.
Sorry. Also, don't forget that, of course, to do so and to be physically be able to do so, this camera has to be locked down to actually create those six exposures, and you have to be tethered. So this is not something that you just, you know, shoot out of the hip with it, and that makes it a very specialized tool. However, as we kind of mentioned before we went live. You know, in any business, if you have a specialized business, you have to make certain investments. And that is one of those investments. If that's your business, that you document the Declaration of Independence or whatever before it falls apart. What is $45,000 versus, oh my God, the Swiss guy trying to speak English. What is $45,000 versus a document of that value? It's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be nice to have one of these cameras up on the International Space Station? It would cost far more to get the camera there than the camera's actually worth. So there's a lot of scenarios that we could talk about that kind of bring that back into reasonable thought. It's not something that is so outlandish, but you've got to have the proper scenario where it becomes valuable. And the average photographer is not going to be in that scenario, but it's fun to see this gear come out on the market and get that, gear lust over it. You know, the gear acquisition syndrome for me has not gotten so bad that I take out a second mortgage to buy one. But we'll see. Time will tell. Let's move on to the final story here. And this one I kind of threw in because I knew that you would probably have an opinion on it, Stefan. This is, it was reported all over the place. It made mainstream news, actually. I linked to an article from F-Stoppers, where a wedding photographer is accused of, quote, fat shaming after over-editing engagement photos. So essentially, a photographer gets hired. And their clients are overweight. There's no question when we look at the images. They're bigger than you and me. And the problem is when you have to deliver something to a client, they want to look their best on their very best, especially if you're doing an engagement shoot, a wedding shoot. And you know, if somebody spills a bit of mustard on their shirt, You know, you want that gone, right? You know, if somebody's got like a really hard line because the light coming across for whatever reason is creating a shadow on their neck that might be odd and uncomfortable, you might want that gone as well. Where do you draw the line on that, though, if you haven't discussed the possibilities for editing with your client beforehand? Will you tuck in their chin a little bit? Will you take a couple of pounds off their waist? Is there something that the client needs to know beforehand? So I asked that question because this photographer was contacted by their client and said, you know, I didn't ask you to, I'm paraphrasing here, but I didn't ask you to edit the images in these ways, you know, reducing some of those signs of being obese, you know, the second chin and what have you. And basically he posted to a private photographers only community. Or at least it's a closed community. I'm not sure who's in there and who isn't. But he was basically complaining about the whole ordeal, putting down the clients. You know, basically, if I was having a conversation with you over a beer and it was just you and me, and it was something that I, you know, somebody just ripped me a new one and I needed to vent about it for some reason, there's a time and a place, I suppose, to have those kinds of discussions. But I wouldn't really have that within a group setting, and I wouldn't really want to have a record of that. And I certainly would not call my clients, like in this particular post, specifically labeled them as, quote, morbidly obese. Well, it turns out that the client found this post somehow, some way. I have no idea. Maybe they were looking for a fight specifically. And it all kind of goes downhill from there. We don't need to get into the weeds of everything, but basically the photographer tries to defend themselves, removes the post, blah, blah, blah. The real discussion here is, how do you deal with clients, especially because I know you and me, we both spend a lot of time editing our work, typically to make things better for anybody involved, but there has to be expectations set from the beginning. Am I right? You take off from here.
All right. I love that story. I love that story for many reasons. Number one, it just shows a little bit of stupidity on each side, which often is the cause for trouble, I think. It would be so easy. The world would be such a lovely place if we would just talk to each other rather than using social media to fight things out. I think a lot of three or four points actually went wrong in the whole story. Number one, as you said correctly, we all have to vent once in a while. We all have whatever the reason is. The energy prices going up. Ah, F this, F that. Fine. That's a human thing, right? But don't do it on social media. That's just stupidity. If you then say, well, it was in a closed group, there is no such thing as a closed group. It may appear like a closed group, but maybe someone in that closed group doesn't like you or doesn't like your opinion or whatever, and share something out of that group. Just keep it between human beings. Discuss it over a beer, or just talk to yourself in the mirror if you need to. But there's certain things that, as a photographer that offers a service, and that's a very important little word, service. If you offer a service, you have to be aware that some clients are amazing. And then you will also walk into some clients which are a little bit more difficult. And then there are also, I'm sorry to say it, some assholes out there. That's just life. And we have to deal with this. Now, the way to deal with this is not after the fact, but beforehand. We have to have a conversation with that person or that couple or that group or that client or whoever it is, what the expectations are. Are your expectations to look like a supermodel? If that's the case, Liquify will go overdrive if you are obese. If, however, you are comfortable in your body and you want to be shown as you are in real life, then that's fine too. Because at the end of the day, beauty is one thing only, a question of taste. There is no right, there's no wrong. You like blue, I like purple, my wife likes orange. We're all correct. So what is beauty? Beauty is an imaginary thing that changes with each person's eyes. How can we be so arrogant to say, I'm going to retouch the image until you are beautiful, when I have never discussed with you how you see beauty?
Exactly.
That is just plain stupid.
That's the key. You have to have the discussion. You've got to sit down with your client and kind of get inside their head to understand what they are expecting from this shoot. And you have to sometimes ask blunt questions at the beginning, because you need to get it all out in the air, out in front of the client right then and there. Because you can say, I will be editing your photographs. Do you put a limit on what you want? Do you want the mud on your pants removed if that happens to be? If there happens to be, somebody is a little bit too red in the cheeks, or the makeup is not exactly perfect, do you want me to touch that up? You've got to ask these questions to some degree and get all of the expectations from the customer or the client. And then after you've gone through a few lists, ask them, what would you like me to do beyond this? You know, I want to make this perfect for you. And so is there anything that you shouldn't, that I should not do? Should I not do this, that, and the other thing? Are you comfortable as yourself? Just like you said, this is a conversation that has to happen when you are enlisting them as a client, when they are hiring you for your service. And I don't do a whole lot of this kind of photography. I've been second shooter on a number of weddings and what have you. And I realized at that point that I really don't want to be a wedding photographer. The brides and the families weren't that bad, but I could just see how awful it could be if you ended up in a bridezilla scenario. And, or mother of Bridezilla, whatever it happens to be, whoever is the main antagonist that is just will never be satisfied, will never be happy with anything, even if you've crossed the T's and dotted the I's beforehand. So I look at photographers like this, and I see this clearly as a mistake on the photographer's part. Some clients, again, will never be happy. Some clients are out there looking for, I don't want to say a fight specifically, but they want to defend themselves if they're being talked ill of. And I would want to be as well.
Yeah, well, there is I mentioned the word service before, as in a capital word importance. I think where people go wrong is like, I mean, you can call someone obese. This is a medical term, which is descriptive. It's correct. It's not, in any way bad. But of course, I mean, shall I go out and call people fat? No, I would not do that. That's just not my lingo. But obese is a correct word. But it's a question of where do you use that word? Don't be so stupid and unprofessional if you want to call it fat shame or just talk badly about any client. Even the worst clients are not discussed with other people. That's just not correct. You fix the problem with the client. You make sure the client is happy. If, and I come back to that word service, if you created those photos as a service. Now, here is the other side of things. If I hire a person, a model, because I have a certain idea, then I'll discuss with them the idea. You will be completely photoshopped. It will all be a composite. There will be smoke coming out of your ears. There will be flames coming out of your nose. This and that and the other. I am now.
Well, in that case,
I'm working now as an artist.
The model is this. Yeah, the model is providing a service to you.
Correct.
That point.
Even then, I have to explain more or less what my idea is. But now that is a very different story. Now the service is not on my side. I am now hiring someone else, or I maybe just give them a carton of beer or whatever the payment is, or maybe they just come to have those photos for themselves and it's on a TFB basis or whatever. But even then, it's important to have that conversation beforehand so everybody is excited and comes in and says, oh my God, we're going to create this. And in that case, because you asked that question, when is Photoshop going too far? What shall we do? I think it really depends. Do I create something from my side? And then I think the sky's the limit. I can do whatever I want. Because if that that person in front of me is not happy with it, we discussed it beforehand, they can say, it's not for me, that's fine. But if I provide a service to someone else, if I shoot for someone else, then I have to be very, very careful what I do. Now, the beautiful thing, purely from a professional point of view, financially, and to protect myself, look at it this way. If I have a checklist and I provide a service and I'm running into this couple, this or another couple, and I'm asking them all the tricky questions, very quickly, I will get a good feel of who they are. Are there those who will be happy with the photos? Are there more or less a couple that might be in for a fight? Are they bargain hunters or do they want some great photos? By having those conversations before and having those tricky questions before, I very quickly get a good feeling, a good gut feeling. Do I actually want that client? And that might actually already save me from the bridezillas by having those conversations before. Number two, the financial aspect. If I discuss these things beforehand, we all know retouching can be a very time-consuming thing. And we don't want to do this for free. So if I have those conversations beforehand, and you mentioned the mud on the pants and this and that, if you shoot on location, if you're smart, you're setting out your fees for the shoot, the session fee, then you submit small, low-resolution images. They look through them. They're completely unretouched. And then they pick the photos that they want retouched. And now you charge them by the hour for the retouching. Because at the end of the day, you want to be smart and you want to be still in business tomorrow. You can't just retouch wildly out there and spend days and days and days without being paid for it. Now,
if you take a look at how much that actually boils down to hours or dollars per hour, oftentimes if you retouch everything to your heart's content, you're working for less than minimum wage, especially for some of these, you know, more budget conscious clients, because if they're not going to be charged for it specifically, they're going to come up with a huge list of demands even after you've edited everything.
And the beautiful thing is now you have the consent from the client that they want certain retouches done because they demand it. Number two, you're paid for it. And number three, you now also have set the limits of where your services end. So there is no open end, oh, can you, and oh, by the way, and can we change the color of the umbrella in the background? Sure, we can do this. This costs you $80 an hour. And that way, you're actually approaching the whole process in as a service provider in a professional way. You're having the conversation first, which then determines your price because you have to quote for it. It gives you the chance to say no thank you if you feel uncomfortable with a couple, because listen to your gut feeling. When you do the job, do it smart, be professional. And a lot of things in that article, they have gone wrong. Not the article itself, but the whole story gone wrong. Because, simple as that, if you shoot for $250, then you are obviously not an experienced professional. And then everything that else goes with it has come out of, I guess, inexperience and stupidity. I'm sorry to say it like that.
But hey, some lessons are learned the hard way. But at this point, this kind of a screw up, I mean, it really, really hurts your professional credibility to other clients. And it, you know, it might not be the kind of thing that goes away very quickly. I'm not sure how many of your other clients might research you and your reputation that are, you know, shown off by others. But if you were to type that particular photographer's name into Google, I'm sure this story would come up. And that, you know, well, maybe you completely rebrand yourself or you just walk away from this and do something else, because some mistakes are really hard to pick up and run away from.
Are you telling me?
Nobody listening to this will make the same mistakes, but.
Are you telling me that the internet remembers everything. So in other words, I should stop with the nude selfies. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, if you're posting them in the right venue and you've got a good audience that loves them, well, who knows, Stefan? But so long as they don't cross my feed, you just keep doing your thing.
There's a lot of blind people out there who love my nude selfies.
All right. Well, let's end the story on that note, shall we? let's carry on to the final segment that I want to put in today, the picks of the week. And I've got one here that I think is kind of interesting, and it's something that I always recommend to my macro photography students. It's called a third hand tool. And effectively what this is it's a solid cast iron base with some metal alligator clips that swivel around. They often come with a magnifying glass that's also removable. This is a quintessential and very inexpensive tool for macro photography, especially when you're doing tabletop studio stuff. They'll cost you under $10 for one of these. You can just type in third hand tool into Amazon. You'll find a bunch of people selling them. Buy the cheapest one you can because they're all pretty much the same stuff. And I'll use sometimes two or three of these in some of my tabletop setups in order to carefully place a flower in a specific location or to hold a branch of something or just to align the visual ingredients in exactly the way that they are needed to be done. You'll see these often used if you look at any of the behind the scenes images of my water droplet refraction photographs, for example. So for less than $10 as a photographic tool, I think this is a really easy, no-brainer solution. It's funny because if this was sold in a camera store, it would be $50. But typically, they're designed for like soldering and jewelry and other really fine work that might require steady hands or more hands than you have. So if anybody out there is interested in macro photography and hasn't yet started to create their own setups and stage their own scenes, this is the tool that you need to make that happen.
And you can pinch people with it.
You can do that too. and I know it's not exactly in your wheelhouse to get one of these, Stefan, but I'm wondering if you have a pick of the week that you could recommend as well.
But it's a little bit left field. The funny thing is we generally, as photographers, spend money in gear that we use to create the next image. I would like to talk people into printing more. And one of the things that I've started is we always think in printing as in canvases or big prints on the wall. What I've started, which you can see, unfortunately, the audio podcast is not there. Behind me, there are actually two cushions with photos or portraits that I've created. And I've started printing on cushions and on bed sheets and that kind of stuff as presents for other people. And the interesting thing is being a little bit selfish, the advertising value that such a cushion has when you print it and give it to somebody and they put it in their office or in their reception room or wherever, every single person looking at it goes like, wow, that is so cool. And because it's a present, they will then, whoever got that present, they will talk to the next person that comes in. They're like, oh, those cushions are really funky. I said, oh yeah, photographer so-and-so did those for us. And it's photos of themselves. So instead of buying the next gear that produces the next photo, maybe you invest $20, $30, $40 in a marketing tool that is actually tangible and has your photo on it. Look at it as an investment or just as a great present. But just, I'd like to open the horizon of people thinking not just in prints as in something that you hang on the wall, but get t-shirts done, get cushions done. I love those cushions. They look great. And the ones that are right behind me, they're actually from a job that I've done for a jewelry company, where, by the way, I had to use one of those gizmos that you just showed to hold the jewelry in place. But I've actually printed or made those cushions for them. And then when I handed over my files, because they want digital files, of course, for advertising, with the digital files, I handed over two cushions and said, here you go. I know you got this big couch in your office. And they're still sitting there, pristine. Nobody is allowed to touch them because they have a certain emotional value because it's their photos that are produced for them. But it just added so much more and it cost me hardly anything. So that
would where do you get these printed? I'm sure a lot of people offer them, but you seem to have success with these. Where did you get them done?
Red Balloon. What is it called? Not Red Balloon. Put it in a show note. I will let you know in a second.
All right. No worries. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there, but that is a great idea. Makes me think that I should print some of my snowflakes onto cushions. I'm sure people would enjoy that as a nice little gift.
Yeah.
That's a great marketing piece.
Yeah. And especially, you know, the world loves snowflakes and they love Frozen and they're all going to sing Let It Be and Let It Go and Let It Whatever. On a bedsheet, I think people have a certain limited idea of what to do with their photos. And I mean, the worst case scenario would be that photos just end up sitting somewhere on a dark corner of a hard drive. And the first thing, of course, is printing them for the wall. But printing tangible products like cushions or bed sheets or t-shirts or so, I think it just is a very different, beautiful thing that we can then hand over. And it's not done enough. And this is just something I discovered. And since I do it, I love it. So maybe that's an idea for someone else.
It's a great idea. And I hope other people take up that particular tool as not necessarily a primary marketing piece, but something that accents what you're currently doing and adds a nice wow factor, especially if it's for a client that you've just worked for, then it leaves the best possible impression, exceeding their expectations. It's a really cool idea. Thanks for sharing that. Stefan, and what would you have kind of coming up next? What is the big thing that's going to keep you busy over the next little while, or any adventures that you have in the near future?
Well, next is coffee. I think the next on my list is coffee. On a serious note, just this morning, my wife and I booked our flights to New York, which will be amazing. My wife runs a ballet academy and she actually goes for one of the biggest ballet competitions in the world, YHEP, which is Youth American Grand Prix, which is held in New York, which dancers from all over the world go and compete. So she will be there for this and I will tag along as a photographer. I am in contact with several people in the New York ballet and dance scene. And there will be a lot of meetings and some amazing photos that we will create on the streets of New York, which I really look forward to. But it's a very selfish trip, but I think that's important that we have to do these kind of things. So not everything always has to be paid for. This is something that we pay for ourselves, just to treat ourselves and to get away from the kids for a week.
You got to have those personal projects.
You just have to, because you have to make sure that you're still going to bed with a big smile on your face. Otherwise, you burn out. So this is something that I really look forward to and completely self-funded. And I just do this because I love it. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then in July, I'll be at the In Focus conference in New Zealand, which also will be really, really cool, where I will speak about dance photography, actually. Will be interesting because it's a wide array of people who are there who speak, from Sue Bryce, who does, you know, portraiture and boudoir and these kind of things, down to the little Swiss guy who will talk about jumping dances. And it will be a great 4 days in July. Wellington, at that time of the year, will be freezing cold, but who cares? It will be fun and will be awesome. So it's these kind of things that keep me going. The other thing that keeps me going, aside from my normal photography and music projects, is of course still the Arcanum. I'm still hanging in there. I have, I don't know, I think 17, 18 amazing apprentices who love photography, and we're having a great time. And yeah, there's tons of these kind of small little things that keep me happy. Not financially, not for any big reasons, just to keep a smile on my face. And I might have said that now about 12 times during this podcast, but that's what drives me. I need to be happy, because otherwise, if I'm not happy, how can I make anyone else happy?
Exactly. And I'm also a master in the Arcanum, and I've got about the same number of apprentices. We have a great time. It's not as valuable financially for the amount of time that I put in as some of the other things that I do, but I enjoy it. And every week we have a hangout with my apprentices. And this week it's actually coming up quite soon, in about a half an hour from the recording time on this. So we should probably wrap up, but it's great to see that you're pursuing your passions. And you know what? Those passions, no matter whether it be music or photography or teaching, in all of these different venues, it's keeping you energized and enthusiastic and inspired while still being able to pay the bills. And to find that balance, I think you're very lucky. And me as well. I mean, I'm in the same boat, and I don't take it for granted one bit. It's been a long road to get here, a lot of 100-hour weeks and, sleepless nights. And it's not been an easy path necessarily, but at the end of it all, it's been one that I would go on again and again without a second thought. So to anybody listening, I mean, we've been rambling for quite a lengthy time, one of our over hour long episodes. So take your passion in hand and get out and shoot.